And now, without further ado, it is my distinct privilege to introduce to you Senator Lee of Utah, the keynote address for this evening. Senator Lee developed a keen respect for the Constitution at a very young age in the gallery of the Supreme Court, watching his father, Rex Lee, the Solicitor General under President Reagan, argue cases before the court. He attended BYU and Brigham Young University Law School, where he was the Federalist Society chapter president. After law school, he clerked for Judge D. Benson on the District Court for the District of Utah, and then Judge Alito on the Third Circuit. After that, he went to Sidley and Austin in D.C. and did appellate work before returning to Utah to be an AUSA in Salt Lake City. After that, he was the general counsel to Governor John Huntsman, and then returned to D.C. to clerk for now Justice Alito on the Supreme Court. In 2007, he returned to private practice before running for the Senate in 2010, obviously winning. I've had the privilege of speaking with Senator Lee at the table this evening, and I've learned that he has a keen understanding of the limited constitutional role of the government, an understanding that is unfortunately all too rare among D.C. politicians, including those who profess to be former constitutional law professors from Harvard. That's probably more of a Harvard thing, though, than anything else. Senator Lee serves on the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, and he's the ranking member of the Subcommittee for Antitrust, Competition Policy, and Consumer Rights. Senator Lee.
Thank you very much, Barbara, and thanks to all of you for letting me talk to you this evening. It's been a while since I've been to Stanford. I think the last time I was here was 15 or 16 years ago when I last came to the student symposium as a third-year law student. And I was the president of the BYU Federalist Society not just 1 year, but 2 years. We boasted the largest student chapter in the entire country at the time, a feat that we obtained through something that I can describe only as conscription. We didn't violate any laws at the time. I am glad to be back, and this is a great audience. The Federalist Society is a fantastic organization that I'm pleased to have been a part of almost my entire life. I think I might be the only member of the United States Senate who actually began attending Federalist Society events when I was in law school. When I was in high school, I traveled down with a group of my fellow teenage Republican friends from my high school to our local law school to hear Robert Bork speak at an event sponsored by the BYU Federalist Society, and I've been a big fan of the institution ever since then. It's been an interesting year for me, becoming acclimated to the United States Senate. I'll tell you a brief story about getting to the Senate. It's an interesting thing. I was 39 years old when I was elected. I'm the youngest member of the Senate. I've got Marco Rubio by a week in that regard. I had served as a Senate page back in 1987. I was pretty sure when I showed up, a lot of the security guards still thought I was a page, and most of the senators did as well. It became a little bit of a problem because, you know, although I'm no spring chicken now, and I am 40, although I am reading at the level of a 41-year-old, I look younger than most of my Senate colleagues, which isn't saying much, I guess, because my friend Jason Chaffetz, who serves in the House, says that the most exciting thing that we have in the Senate are the activities we have on Wednesday night, which involve shuffleboard and wheelchair races. It's a fair criticism, I suppose. But when I get to the door of the Senate chamber each day when I'd go to vote, these large hulkish characters wielding guns would stand in front of me and say, no, you can't go in there, you're not a senator. And so I'd prove to them, I'd take out my, I got carded. I'm from Utah, I don't drink, I'm not used to getting carded, but I discovered when people do that, you have to produce a card. So there's my Senate card, I'd show that to them and they'd say, okay, go on in, you can vote. After a while, I figured out this neat little trick. They give you a little lapel pin. I should have worn it tonight. I call it my sorry senator pin, because when you wear it, you point to it, the Capitol Police are trained to notice it, and they say, oh, that's a senator. So now when they stop me, I point to the lapel pin, And they say, oh, sorry, Senator, and they come on in. It works most of the time. Not all of the time. Just a few weeks ago, I was on the floor of the Senate, in the well, in between votes, thinking great, great thoughts. I was leaning on the desk ever so slightly like this, with my hand resting gently on the desk. This guy from the Sergeant at Arms office comes up to me, and he doesn't look happy, and he says, will you please stop leaning on the Senator's desk? These desks are about 200 years old, like most of my colleagues. I'm from Utah. I respond well to authority. I stood at attention. I'm so sorry. I didn't realize I was leaning on it. And he says, are you with the minority? I didn't know what he meant by that. I said, you mean on this vote? I don't always vote with my party. Usually do. I don't, on the last vote or this vote? No, do you work for the minority leader? Well, I work for the people of Utah. I like Mitch McConnell, but I don't know that I work for him. No, are you a member of the minority leader's staff? Then I started realizing what was going on. I did this. He didn't recognize the sorry senator pin. It didn't work. I hate using my title when introducing myself to anyone. I always call myself my Mike. I don't like using my title, and I saw that I was going to have to do it, and so I did it quietly. I'm Senator Lee. What? I'm a senator. What? I'm Senator Lee. All of the color drained from his face at that point, and he said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. My name is Steve if you want to report me. And then he left. I felt bad for the guy. I tried to chase after him. Hey, buddy, it's no big deal. Every time I see Steve now, I say, hi, Steve, just so he knows there's no hard feelings. I'm convinced the guy's name is probably Bob, and Steve is the name of a coworker that he hates. But you know what? This has proven to be kind of a metaphor for me. Sometimes there are things that we have to assert, whether as senators or as citizens, that are rightfully ours. And though it may be uncomfortable, we have to assert them. The non-assertion of those very same things can result in their forfeiture. Just like, had I not said that day, Steve, if that really is his name, might have hauled me away and I wouldn't have been able to vote. We have to assert that which is rightfully ours. Tonight, I'd like to talk to you for just a little bit about asserting that which is rightfully ours in a very important area of the law. Specifically, I want to talk to you about the implications of the modern administrative state, what that's doing to our rights, our individual liberties as a country, to our economy, and how we turn this around. It was with good reason that our founding fathers decided to put the lawmaking power in the hands of Congress. They understood that whenever you're assigning the power to legislate, that's going to affect a lot of rights. And they also understood that bad things can happen when the people who make the laws don't answer to the people. So it really was no accident that they made this pretty clear in Article 1, Section 1, and in Article 1, Section 7. They said the power to legislate will be vested in Congress. This is Article 1, Section 1. And the Congress shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. Then in Article 1, Section 7, they made the point even more clear. In order to legislate, you have to go through a few really important steps. First, there has to be bicameral passage of the legislation in question. Then there has to be presentment to the president. The president has to have the opportunity to either sign the law or veto the law or allow it to pass into law without signature or veto. This was really important because they knew that a lot of damage could occur if all of a sudden you had people making laws that weren't accountable to anyone else. Benjamin Franklin is famous for having said he'll cheat without scruple, who can without fear. There is a legislative corollary to that. He'll make really, really, really bad laws who never has to stand for election. But that's exactly, unfortunately, what we have today, and there's a lot of it. Let me explain what I mean. Last year, in 2011, Congress passed just under 3,000 pages worth of new statutory text, new law. Some would say this was 3,000 pages too many. Maybe it was. Maybe they're right. But it pales. It's dwarfed in comparison to the amount of law that was promulgated by what some refer to, Knox so affectionately, as the fourth branch of government, the modern administrative bureaucratic state. Last year, the Federal Register, the year-to-date record of all the new proposed and proposed revised regulations, over 82,000 pages of new law, 3,000 pages enacted by the people's duly elected representatives, 82,000 pages of new law from the existing administrative bureaucratic state. Now, this is added on top of the existing corpus of federal regulatory law found in the Code of Federal Regulations, which currently comprises about 160,000 pages. So this is an awful lot of law. This creates some problems. You see, the Supreme Court has long understood what the founding generation understood, which is that you've got to keep this close to the people. Chief Justice Rehnquist said many years ago that by requiring the elected legislature to make our laws, we ensure that important choices of social policy are made by Congress because that is the branch of government that is most responsive to popular will. Most responsive because we know we'll get fired if we make bad laws, if we make laws that really tick people off. Because in the case of representatives, their job is up for review every single two-year period. In the case of senators, every 6 years. This is why we don't allow a lot of grass to grow under our feet. We're constantly moving. We want to avoid being associated with the making of bad law. But if we lose that, bad things are going to happen. The Supreme Court, the Supreme Court gilded that point a little bit more a few years later in INS v. Chadha, when they explained, by providing that no law could take effect without the concurrence of the prescribed majority of members of both houses, the framers reemphasized their belief that legislation should not be enacted unless it has been carefully and fully considered by the nation's elected officials. James Madison predicted in Federalist 51 that this separation of powers, which he explained was of utmost importance to the preservation of liberty and to the effective operation of our constitutional system, would protect itself. Because, as he explained, the great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving those who administer each branch the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachments of the others. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. This, you see, what Madison is describing was the holy grail of the Constitution. The avoidance of concentration of too much power in the hands of any one individual. We had one of my personal heroes, Justice Scalia, in front of the Judiciary Committee not too long ago. I serve on the Judiciary Committee, and he made a great statement. He uttered words to the effect that any tin horn dictator can have a Bill of Rights. I don't know what a tin horn is or what it says about a dictator, but it sounded really nice. But what separates good governments from bad governments isn't the presence or absence of a Bill of Rights. It is instead a structure in place that will prevent the concentration of powers. Prevent any one branch or any one individual from acquiring too much power. So Madison says this happens automatically, necessarily, under our constitutional system. You're not going to have one branch acquiring too much power at the expense of another because each branch has within it both the personal motives to resist that and the constitutional power to resist that. But this isn't exactly what's happened. For a long time, this balance was maintained. But in recent years and recent decades, you've had this phenomenon. 3,000 pages on the one hand, 82,000 pages on the other hand. And it only appears to be getting worse. So was Madison wrong? I don't think he was wrong. I think he was exactly right as far as his analysis went. But I think he failed perhaps to foresee what has happened, which was that the personal motives changed. The personal motives of Congress have, for one reason or another, become inextricably intertwined with this desire to avoid having to make the difficult decisions. Every member of Congress, for example, wants to be known as having voted for things like clean air or clean water, things that are very non-objectionable sounding, things that everybody would want to be part of. So we end up making a law saying we shall have clean air. And by the way, the Environmental Protection Agency shall have power to promulgate, implement, and enforce rules carrying the force of generally applicable law to define exactly what clean air means and decide exactly how that's going to be put in. Why on earth, you might ask, would Congress ever want that to have happen? After all, we're parting with a substantial amount of authority. Well, the reason is simple. We live in a world in which we're constantly confronted by constituents. We don't want to have to face up to the difficult laws. We as an institution want, for our constituents to be able to come in and say, I don't like this law. It's the greatest thing in the world when you say, hey, don't get mad at me. I just voted for clean air. If you don't like the rule, go raise your complaint with the EPA. So what happens when you go to the EPA? I don't like this new standard dealing with haze or smog or mercury or whatever it is. They look at you as if you have antennas growing out of your head when you say, I don't like this rule. They look at you and say, I don't care who you are. Get out of here. You're a peasant. We don't deal with peasants here at the EPA. If you don't like what we did, sue us. So you go to court. What happens when you get to court? Well, under the APA, of course, as long as you can establish the basic minimum standards, that the EPA is going to argue this was within our authority. And so this law stands regardless of what you may think about it, so long as you can't prove that it's arbitrary and capricious. Well, that's a pretty deferential standard, and it almost always results in the law standing. And so this is how we get to this point where Congress no longer has the motive to protect its own power. Congress outsources the legislative prerogative to people who are neither elected by the American voter, nor accountable to anyone who is. And this represents the beginnings of tyranny. Now, if you think I'm overstating that a little bit, fair point, but let me try to disabuse you of that notion. When I refer to this as tyranny, I don't think it's really all that far off, because the modern administrative state tries to regulate just about everything. Let me give you a couple of examples. The first one comes from the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA's website says as follows. This is really interesting observation into the psyche of those who operate these government bureaucracies. In regulating about 25% of the United States economy, they're openly bragging about this. The FDA is responsible for the safety and effectiveness of $2 trillion worth of products a year. Now, when you read further on the FDA website, you look at some of FDA's own regulations. You see some interesting things. You see that this includes the regulation of such high matters of federal concern as the kind of turtles that you can buy at your local pet store. I doubt many of you knew that you could end up in prison for up to a year for selling the wrong kind of turtle. You end up in prison if you sell a turtle with, and I quote, from 24 CFR section 1240.62. If you sell any turtle with a, quote, carapace length less than 4 inches. I know what you're all wondering. What on earth is a carapace? I didn't know either before I got ready for this speech. It means shell. I don't know why they couldn't have just said shell. But they're experts, right? And when they use words like carapace, we trust them. We trust them more than those very plain-spoken representatives of the peasants who serve in the Congress, people who are not experts. That's why we trust them. That's why we pay them the big bucks, because they use words like carapace. I also found out that turtles fall into the order of Testudinata and the class Reptilia. This is a very important information. They're the experts. They know these things. Let me give you another example. of where the administrative regulatory state kind of gets out of control. They get into minutiae. They get into things that are really, frankly, none of their business as federal officials. Here's a couple from Idaho. Their names are Michael and Chantel Sackett. Not too long ago, they bought some property in a residential development, and they went to go develop that. They were going to build a house on it. This was a fairly ordinary piece of property. It was less than 3/4 of an acre. It was surrounded on 2 of the 4 sides by through streets within this developed neighbor. By 2 of the other sides, they were abutted by adjacent residential lots. This is a very ordinary piece of property. I've seen pictures of it. There was no water flowing through it. All I saw were a bunch of dry rocks. Well, they went through the title search process, did all their due diligence, got their local building permits. They were ready to build. They were getting ready to build, and they put some fill dirt on it. And just as they were getting ready, they got that visit that everyone fears from people wearing suits saying, "Hi, we're here from the government, and we're here to help." Some people from the EPA came, and they said, "These are wetlands." And they said, "No, they're not. We checked. We looked at the EPA's, on the EPA's own maps. These are not wetlands. Moreover, there's nothing even wet on the property. There are no turtles there." Before they knew it, they were being told that they had to comply with a series of orders from the EPA. And unless they complied with those orders, they would face mounting fines of up to $37,500 every single day. And that the order included such things as they had to re-landscape the thing, they had to remove all their fill dirt, they had to plant specific kinds of hardwood trees that were native to the area. Remember, this is a residential neighborhood. This is basically a tract home area. This is not wilderness area. And yet they're telling them to do this. It reminded me of that scene in Monty Python's Search for the Holy Grail where they tell them they have to bring back a shrubbery. This one was worse, though, because they didn't have civil monetary penalties of $37,500 a day. So, make a long story short, this case ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court. It's pending and under advisement in the Supreme Court right now. But what I thought was interesting about that case, which involves all kinds of issues involving due process and ripeness and the availability of judicial review, what I found very interesting about that, without getting into all those due process issues, was when I looked at the Supreme Court brief. This is an odd hobby I picked up from my late father. May he rest in peace. I like to read Supreme Court briefs. I don't know why. I just really enjoy it. I looked at their brief, and there's a part at the beginning of every Supreme Court brief where you're required to list, before the text of your brief really begins in earnest, all of the statutory provisions at issue. They listed all the statutory provisions at issue, and here's what I found. Of the substantive, non-procedural statutory provisions at issue from the Clean Water Act, I found what the EPA's source of authority was for coming in and stopping their construction within this residential neighborhood, within this tract home neighborhood, basically. 3 provisions. First, from the Clean Water Act, the following statutory text: "The discharge of any pollutant by any person shall be unlawful." Who could be against that, right? You don't want people who are discharging pollutants. Those are bad. It defined the discharge of a pollutant as, quote, "any addition of any pollutant to navigable waters from any point source." Who could be against that? Polluting navigable waters, that's a bad thing. And then it defined navigable waters as, quote, "the waters of the United States, including the territorial seas." There's absolutely nothing in any of the relevant substantive statutory text that says one word about a landlocked parcel of land in Idaho with no sign of anything wet, much less a navigable waterway, in the middle of Idaho. And yet, these guys somehow have the authority to do that, because along with this very innocuous-sounding statutory text, You had other language that said the EPA shall have power to implement and promulgate and enforce rules carrying the force of generally applicable law, saying exactly what all this stuff means. So the Sackets, of course, went to their members of Congress, who explained there was really nothing they could do. This is where the system breaks down. This is where Federalist 51 is proven wrong, or at least proven to have been circumvented here. Because all of a sudden, you're working against the institutional prerogatives. You're working against the personal interest of individual members of Congress. And little by little, we're forfeiting our individual liberties. And this is a big problem. So we have to get back to what it means to have the power to legislate. The power of legislate, again, under Article 1, Section 1 and Article 1, Section 7, is assigned to Congress, not to anyone else, not to any executive branch agency. And that begs the question, what does it mean to legislate? Well, I think it means the power to adopt any rule carrying the force of generally applicable law. It's one thing if you're adopting a regulation within the U.S. Department of Energy that specifies when the lights are going to go on and when the lights are going to go off within that department. It's quite another thing if you're talking about a regulation that affects people, that affects individual members of the public. It's a generally applicable rule of law. Once you've reached that point, we've crossed into the threshold of some kind of legislation, and Congress ought to have to pass that into law. I think one of the ways that Congress started walking down this rat hole was that decades ago, it realized that it could maybe have it both ways. Congress started saying, look, we'll part with some of this lawmaking power, we'll give it over to this executive branch agency, but we'll give ourselves an escape clause. And they did this a lot, hundreds and hundreds of times. They adopted legislation that gave power to an executive branch agency with an escape clause. It was called the legislative veto. And it was a brilliant thing for those in Congress who really liked it, because they'd say, you can promulgate this regulation, but if we don't like it, Congress can just veto it. Only problem was it was unconstitutional. As the Supreme Court concluded in INS v. Chadha in 1983, you can't have the last act in any legislative action occur entirely within the Article I branch, occur entirely within Congress. You have to have, after passage through the bicameral process, presentment to the president. Without that additional step, the Supreme Court concluded, you've violated the constitutional process necessary for legislation. So they adopted that, but for some reason, they never got back around to saying, okay, let's rescind all those delegations of our lawmaking power. And for some other odd reason, the Supreme Court has never closed the loop. The Supreme Court has never stepped in and said, well, it's not okay for Congress to undertake the last act if it's vetoing what occurred in the legislative branch. But if you're legislating from the beginning within the legislative branch, that ought to be a problem too, and I think it is. Now, there is a solution to this, fortunately. And it's a relatively easy solution. It's a solution that at least has its beginnings in a legislative proposal that I'm proud to be the co-sponsor of in the Senate called the RAINS Act, R-E-I-N-S. The RAINS Act says essentially as follows. Anytime you have a new rule proposed by an executive branch agency, a rule carrying the force of generally applicable law, if that rule is one that carries with it an economic impact of $100 million or more annually, such that it qualifies as a major rule for purposes of the OMB review process, that rule will not take effect unless or until both houses of Congress have affirmatively passed it and they've submitted it to the president for signature or veto. This would change everything. All of a sudden, you could have these regulations proposed, they just wouldn't take effect until Congress duly enacted them into law. This is what we need to do. This is what we must do. I think it's what we will do, and it will benefit the American economy. And if you don't believe me, just look at the Congressional Budget Office estimate. It estimates that every year Americans spend an estimated $1.75 trillion in complying with federal regulations. $1.75 trillion. There are people right here in Palo Alto who do not make $1.75 trillion in a year. But seriously, that rivals what we collect through our federal income tax system. That's an enormous amount of money, and yet that's what we spend complying with that. That doesn't mean that all these regulations are going to go away. It just means Congress, a body that's accountable to the people, will have to respond to it. Now, there are those who are going to say, look, you can't do away with this system. We've got to maintain the status quo for a couple of reasons. First, they say, we need the expertise of the federal agency to do this. Another way of saying that is you can't trust these unwashed masses and their representatives in Congress to do the real thing. You've got to have experts. Well, let me tell you what one champion of federalism, one champion of limited government had to say about that. This guy's name, incidentally, was Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was a champion of those things before he wasn't. In a speech that he gave while governor of New York in 1930, Franklin D. Roosevelt said the following. He gave this speech condemning, quote, the doctrine of regulation by masterminds, in whose judgment and will all the people may gladly and quietly acquiesce. Were it possible to find such masterminds, people so unselfish, so willing to decide unhesitatingly against their own personal interests or private prejudices, men almost godlike in their ability to hold the scales of justice with an even hand, such a government might be to the interest of the country. But there are none such on our political horizon, and we cannot expect a complete reversal of all the teachings of history. Then Governor Roosevelt went on to describe this kind of government by these masterminds as government by oligarchy masquerading as democracy. I couldn't have said it better myself. I wonder, was Franklin D. Roosevelt a member of the Federalist Society? I don't know. He should have been if it existed then. It's ironic that he made these statements because he is, in many respects, the patron saint, the godfather, and the grandfather of the modern administrative state. But at least while he was governor, he understood this principle. He bought it. He grasped onto the fact that when we have this amount of law elected by people who are neither elected by the voters nor accountable to anyone who is, we have, in effect, government by oligarchy masquerading as democracy. So the fact that people are experts hardly means that they ought to be able to legislate without any accountability to the people. And so we have to be ready to dismiss that argument out of hand very quickly for the red herring that it absolutely is. The next argument that frequently arises in response to this concern is people say, well, how on earth could Congress possibly keep up with the sheer volume of regulations that comes through? How could Congress be expected to vote that often? After all, we're talking about 82,000 pages a year, which I say exactly. That's part of the problem. Our founding fathers understood that one of the main problems that we could confront as a society within our representative government, within our republic, would be the creation of too many laws. And if this did slow down the lawmaking power, we'd all be better off. Here's what James Madison said in Federalist 62 on this topic, but in a context that actually was far less severe than the one we're dealing with here. He said, it will be of little avail to the people that the laws are made by men of their own choice. They were men back then. I'm sorry for Mr. Madison's political incorrectness in that. I'm sure he meant men in the gender-neutral sense. It will be of little avail to the people that their laws may be made by men of their own choice if the laws be so voluminous that they cannot be read, or so incoherent that they cannot be understood, if they be repealed or revised before they are promulgated, or undergo such incessant changes that no man who knows the law and what it is today can guess what it will be tomorrow. Law is defined to be a rule of action, but how can that be a rule which is little known and less fixed? This is exactly the problem we have when we have 82,000 pages of new law created every year. This would be a problem even if it were passed by a duly elected group of representatives. But the problem is compounded, the problem exists a fortiori, when the group of people are not men of the choosing of the people, but rather nameless, faceless bureaucrats who, while good Americans just trying to do their job like everyone else, aren't elected by the people and aren't accountable to anyone who is. From time to time, we discover in our great republic that we've gone astray. Whenever that happens, we succeed, we benefit, we prosper to precisely the same degree that we're willing to acknowledge our folly and to resume a course that is consistent with the mandate issued by this almost 225-year-old document that has fostered the development of the greatest civilization the world has ever known. It was with very good reason that those wise men who wrote this document put a process in place that would hold the lawmakers accountable. It is folly to assume that we can continue on a course that ignores that. Lest we fall into this category that Franklin D. Roosevelt so wisely described as oligarchy masquerading as democracy, we must change it. And with legislative proposals like the RAINS Act, we can do it. We can, and we must, and we will. And when we do, we will find that as Americans, we'll benefit as a result, that our greatest days are indeed ahead of us. We do face a lot of challenges in this country, but a lot of them are caused by the government. When we just do the right thing, the government will benefit. I know that as we do these things, we'll benefit, and I know that we can fix them. Let's all join in this cause. Please join me in this effort to restore liberty to the United States of America. May God bless the United States. Thank you very much. I'd be happy now to answer any questions you may have. We've got microphones that are circulating. I assume these very wise experts will know whom to call upon. You can ask me about anything you want. It can be about law or politics or the Senate. I will also dispense fashion advice, relationship tips, and anything you want to know about gardening or stain removal.
Please raise your hand and we'll come and get your questions.
We've got one over there.
Senator, Senator, I wonder if you would comment on the Obama administration's effort to impose a national curriculum in our public schools. Utah's joined into this. I don't know what you think about it, but it seems in conflict with your sense of limited government and federalism.
Any effort by the federal government to so intrude upon a public education system, particularly in the context of primary and secondary education, is an act of utter lawlessness, which I will resist with every fiber in my being. This is a horrible idea. Look, if they want to do this within the District of Columbia, a U.S. territory, a military installation, an Indian reservation, or some federal enclave, let them knock themselves out. But we have absolutely no power to do any of that. We have no business doing that when it comes to the educational system within any state.
Hey.
Yep.
Hey. I think most people in this room agree with the dangers posed by the growth of the regulatory state in modern society. But at the same time, there are a lot of people in our society who very honestly believe that it can improve the way the society is run. How do you convince people who believe that the regulatory society is the answer, to a lot of modern problems, that they're wrong, basically, without alienating them?
Okay, well, on the first level, I don't have to prove to them that they're wrong, because all I have to do is pull this out and say, my copy of this says that Congress makes the laws and not the executive branch bureaucracies that have come to make them. It is the law. We're not following the law, but we need to follow the law. The fact that we haven't followed the law in the past, and that the courts, for whatever reason, I'm not going to blame my friend Judge Griffith on the D.C. Circuit. I'll blame the Supreme Court on this one. The courts have been too lax. The fact that they've been too lax doesn't mean that we don't need to change. So anyway, they're wrong on that point. Secondly, we've got to convince them just by explaining to them that the minute we say we've got to be a government run by experts is the minute we're saying we're willing to accept absolute tyranny by degrees. Because if we live under a government with laws made by people who are not of our own choosing, we are on the road to tyranny. We are experiencing tyranny by degrees, and that never ends well. It always ends in tears.
How you doing, sir? My name is Tosh Kubernik, University of Colorado. If my ignorance is displayed in this, my apologies, but my understanding was that Obamacare was passed on a reconciliation vote, and I was curious if you could explain what type of vote was needed to essentially cancel it out within the Senate.
I'm not understanding your question. What kind of vote would be needed to cancel it out?
To repeal it, my apologies.
Oh, to repeal it.
Yeah,
okay,
sorry.
Okay. Well, yeah, it would be very simple. You run a piece of legislation. This could be my favorite kind of bill, and it could say the Affordable Health Care Act of 2010 is hereby repealed. You run that through both houses of Congress, you submit it to the President, the President signs it, and we're finished. Now, I wish it were that simple. We've got to at least secure the majority in the Senate, and we've at least got to secure the White House before that happens, we meaning someone other than those who currently control it. But yeah, it is at a practical level, a very simple procedure. Yes.
Hey, Senator, I'm a Catholic, and the Obama administration makes it sound like this contraception mandate is a closed question, and I want to know, are you guys going to keep fighting for it to make sure that you know that our religious freedoms are protected in when this health care, if it in fact doesn't get overturned, comes into power?
Yes, absolutely. There are some of us, including especially myself, who are going to keep fighting on this one and until our last breath. Let me explain a couple of the reasons why. First of all, I want to make clear that this is a pretty good example. This meaning this contraception mandate, the mandate saying that if you provide health care to anyone, to your group of employees, we don't care whether you're a religious institution and you're a religious institution that has a strong religious belief and compunction against providing abortifacients and contraceptives to your employees, we're going to make you do it anyway. This is an enormous problem. It is best and most easily understood, I think, is something, it's just the inevitable consequence of what happens when government gets too big. Here's one way that a member of my staff put it. I actually kind of like this. He said, when Godzilla steps on your house and destroys it, he's not doing it because he hates you. He's not doing it because he's trying to eat you. He's doing it because he's Godzilla, and he's huge, and your house is there. That's just what happens. So too with our individual liberties, including our religious liberties. When government gets too big, it doesn't always mean that the government's when it infringes on our religious liberties, it's doing that because it hates religion. Sometimes it is. But it's not always. Sometimes it's just because the government is Godzilla and it's huge and your religious liberties are in the way. And that is what happens. But this one's really, really nasty. Because not only does it represent, I think, a significant free exercise clause problem for relatively obvious reasons, but I think it also arguably presents a significant problem under the Establishment Clause. Because you had the White House putting significant pressure on the military chaplains at the Pentagon not to distribute, not to focus on, not even to tell people about the letter from the Catholic bishops expressing concern over this regulation. And then, of course, you had the lovely compromise without the compromise. The compromise that didn't involve any change in the regulation at all, and that can at best be described as a heads we win, tails you lose compromise. Oh, we'll just have the insurance companies cover it. That didn't change anything at all. So anyway, it's a big problem, and I'm going to continue to fight it. But again, I have to emphasize, this is what happens when government gets too big. It's Godzilla, and your religious liberties are in the way, and all they can say at that point is, sorry, you're out of luck.
Senator, there seem to be a growing proportion of the population that embraces the regulatory state and seems to say, yes, experts, please do indeed rule us as your subjects, including some of the speakers and judges that we've seen here at this conference.
At this conference?
Well, some of the
opposing, raise your hands if you think
opposing
that.
Viewpoints probably didn't come to the banquet.
I'm just kidding. All right.
So to what extent can that or should that be resisted if that seems to be the prevailing notion of the people?
Well, first of all, I hope that it isn't a prevailing notion. I actually highly doubt that it is a prevailing notion. Certainly wouldn't hope that it's a prevailing notion in this room. I was going to ask for a show of hands, but maybe I won't. I'll get scared. I'm pretty sure that it's not, either in this room or elsewhere. I think among the electorate at large, people are just largely unaware of how their laws are made. But they're becoming more and more every single day, because as government gets bigger, ordinary people like Michael and Chantel Sackett in Idaho come to see the federal government. You know, a couple of generations ago, it was not at all unusual for a person to live an entire lifetime and die having very, very little contact with any federal official other than perhaps a member of the U.S. Postal Service. But these days, that's becoming almost impossible. And the more conflict there is, the more people will start to think about where their federal laws are made, and they'll see what a problem that it is. I think that once most voters become aware of this issue, as they're becoming more aware of it every single day, they're going to do the right thing. Because Americans were made for liberty. They're not meant for tyranny. And the path of the administrative lawmaking state is inevitably the path of tyranny. I'm told I've got time for five more questions. No, I'm just kidding. She told me I only have time for one more question. So, there's somebody there with their hand up wearing green. Actually, I'm very confused by these microphones, so I'll just let them do their job.
I hate to.
Now everybody's raising their hands.
I hate to take the last question, but I was going to ask. I know probably in this crowd, moderation in the pursuit of justice is going to be no virtue, but I was wondering if you see any role, any positive role that agencies could play in terms of institutional memory, especially since it seems to be, in your theory, the sort of recourse of the people is to vote people out. Then new people get in who may or may not be sort of prepared to deal with whatever situations the nation faces. And sort of another general question, if you'd rather not address that one, because the answer may be unpopular.
Oh, I want to address that one, but
Would be just what sort of what do you think is the capacity for senators, representatives to respond to the people when there's just so many people within a constituency nowadays? It seems that there's not much direct responsiveness. You probably get thousands and thousands of letters. What's the ability to respond to that? Is there any sort of structural, institutional changes we could make to make government more responsive on your level?
Yeah, okay. Both of them are very good questions. In response to the first one, I want to make very clear, I'm not talking about abolishing all executive branch agencies. Far from it. I'm not saying anything of the sort. I'm simply saying that when we're talking about the creation of new generally applicable rules that carry the force of federal law, that those need to go through Congress before they take effect. we still have these executive branch agencies under the more constitutionally consistent future that I foresee. It's just that before their proposed rules become law, they have to go through Congress. But they're still there. They're still there to provide their expertise. They do have something to offer. And I don't purport for a second to have, either individually or on the part of the Senate, the kind of expertise that is often needed and very helpful within government on issues ranging from those dealt with by FDA to those dealt with by EPA to those dealt with by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So they can still be very helpful. But the new regulations they propose would be considered just that, as proposals. And then beyond that, they'd be enforcement institutions that are there, as the word executive implies, to execute the laws, to implement them, to enforce them. So I'm not talking about making them disappear. I'm just talking about changing the way that new rules that they propose actually become law. With regard to the second part of your question, members of Congress, particularly members of the Senate, do get a lot of correspondence. We do represent a lot of constituents. Your average member of Congress represents, I think the current average is 650 or 700,000 people apiece. I'm from a relatively small state, and so as a senator, I represent about 3 million people, because that's how many people there are in my state. There are other senators from much bigger states, some of whom represent tens of millions of people all at once. I'll tell you how this works generally. We do get a lot of correspondence. We get a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails, and a lot of letters. I have a very diligent staff, as do most of my colleagues, and we try to answer every single phone call, every single email, and every single letter, and we do it within a very short period of time because we want people to understand that we are responding to it. We have regular meetings at which we discuss the nature of the inquiries that are coming in and how we're going to respond to them. And a lot of them follow into one. It seems like every week we'll get most, if not all, of the correspondence will be tracking on one of about 15 issues. Which 15 issues are on the table from week to week will vary. But we always know with some certainty which roughly 15 issues will be addressed, and so we have answers ready to go. So I think we do a pretty good job with that. Now, finally, with regard to the last part of your question, is there anything we can do to make Congress more responsible, to make members of Congress more able to deal on a one-to-one basis with their constituencies? Yeah, I suppose there is one thing we could do. One option that is open to us is to increase the number of people who serve in the House of Representatives. Thank you. I never thought that one would get applause, but I'll have to use that one again. There's no restriction in the Constitution on the number of representatives that we have, except that we can't have more than, Professor McConnell's going to correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's 30,000. I think you can't have more than one for every 30,000 residents. Am I correct, Professor McConnell? I should get applause for that, too. So if we went to that standard, we would have a much, much larger House of Representatives. That would not, in my opinion, necessarily be a bad thing to increase it. I don't know if I'd increase it to where it to want to one to every 30,000. But we could increase it, and I think that would probably be a good thing. I'm sure that it will happen at some point. I just don't know when. Anyway, in closing, thank you for your questions. Thanks so much for letting me talk to you. And thanks for pretending to be interested while listening to a speech about the administrative state.